Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Bassetto, Assistant Professor in Communication and Media at Lund University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's been a while since the last podcast release, but things are back on track, and I've got a bunch of interviews lined up with amazing scholars, so I'm really excited to dive into these topics in the fall, so stay tuned. But what better way to break a podcast drought than a conversation with Professor Chris Bale? He is a professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University and director of the Polarization Lab at Duke. And Professor Bale is one of the world's leading researchers on political polarization and social media. So in this episode, we are going to dive into Professor Bale's latest book. It's entitled Breaking the Social Media Prism: How to Make Our Platforms Less Polarizing, published by Princeton University Press. And that book is a compilation of three individual studies. The first is called Exposure to Opposing Views on Social Media Can Increase Political Polarization. That's published in PNAS, and there'll be a link to it down in the episode description. And in that study, Twitter users were instructed to follow a bot that would tweet them opinions from the other side of the political aisle and assess the implications of that exposure on political polarization. The second study replicates that one, but incorporates qualitative interviews with those Twitter users to try to uncover what's happening in terms of political polarization and their everyday Twitter experiences. And this is what makes the book really fun to read and very accessible, is that a lot of the scientific insights are reported through anecdotes and vignettes from these interviews. And I think we can all more or less kind of identify with some of these people in the book. And finally, in the third study, Professor Bale and his team built an alternative social media platform to put users from opposite sides of the political aisle into dialogue with each other anonymously. So that's fun. And we'll break all of those down, but I can definitely recommend picking up the book and giving it a read. Very accessible, good one to take to the beach, even though we are heading into winter. But regardless, and without further ado, let me turn it over to Professor Chris Bale. Again, he's a professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University. Professor Bale, thanks for taking the time out, and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we take a deep dive into your research on social media and polarization, why don't we start out by discussing the main theoretical argument in your latest book, Breaking the Social Media Prism. And there, you argue that social media functions less like a reflective mirror of society, but rather a refractory prism that distorts our identities and how we perceive our social environment. Could you outline this argument for us? How does social media refract our identities, and how might this contribute to political polarization?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that makes us human is our tendency to kind of cultivate identities that make us feel good about ourselves. You know, we've known this for hundreds of years, long before social media. And we know that people, especially young people, tend to kind of read their social environment and look for clues about which sort of presentation of themselves, which sort of identity is resonating with other people. And so I like to actually even think of it as kind of like a process of social experimentation. You know, we're all kind of constantly trying to figure out, you know, how to fit in and really looking for clues in other people about who we are. And so, you know, the argument of the book is really not so novel in that respect, because that idea is as old as probably Cooley in the early 20th century. But I think the interesting question is kind of, how does social media change that fundamental process of how we experiment with our identities? And I think it basically does it in two ways. The first is that it gives us a much broader palette to experiment with. You know, so on social media, we can be basically whoever we want on some platforms. Of course, other platforms require more kinds of identity verification, but at the very least, we can kind of selectively share information about ourselves. And then on the other end, we have a very powerful mechanism to monitor what other people are thinking about us in the form of like counts, follower counts, and so on. And so I think social media has really profoundly begun to shape the way we construct our identities. And this argument, I think, may even transcend politics, which is really the subject of my book and your podcast. But of course, it's particularly important in politics, because then the questions kind of become, you know, well, what kind of incentive structure does social media create for identities? And the argument I make in the book is essentially that it's created a situation where a small number of people with relatively radical views enjoy a disproportionate voice in most social media discussions. And that's not entirely new. There's a lot of other research that kind of documents that. What's important, and where this prism idea becomes particularly powerful, I think, is when we realize that that small minority of people becomes misunderstood as what most people are like. So if you're a Democrat, your modal experience interacting with a Republican in the US is with someone who's pretty extreme. And then you can confuse that relatively extreme person with most people on the other side and misunderstand the other side as much more extreme than it really is. And so the reason I call this book Breaking the Social Media Prism is to try to capture that dynamic, that we have to get past this kind of fundamental misperception that I think is relatively inevitable given the way that our platforms are currently structured.
Definitely. And I'm really looking forward to diving into these different aspects in detail, because to support this argument, in the book, you report findings from 3 studies, and I'd like to walk through each one of those individually. And the first is a field experiment conducted on Twitter, where participants followed bots programmed to expose them to opinions from the other side of the political aisle. So could you discuss the design of that study? What did you and your team set out to test, and how did you design these bots to make sure that participants were exposed to political viewpoints from the other side?
Yeah, I mean, this was a surprising study to us. It was somewhere around 2016. The world had just seen, you know, the election of Trump, the Brexit referendum, and a number of other sudden events that I think surprised people. You know, people felt like they didn't see it coming. And of course, the idea of social media echo chambers, which I think is a very popular narrative about how social media polarizes us, seemed to provide a pretty tidy explanation of why this happened, right? If you are a Democrat in the United States and you were, an anti-Brexit voter in Britain, and you were surprised by the outcome of Trump or Brexit, it's probably because you were only listening to people who already share your view. And if only social media hadn't segregated us into these kind of echo chambers, or sometimes they're called filter bubbles, to capture the kind of algorithmic reinforcement of selective exposure to the same kind of political information, then you would have known that large numbers of people supported Trump and supported Brexit. So, you know, I kind of shared this view and thought, you know, what if we try to do some research to try to take people outside their echo chambers? Perhaps they'll become more moderate. On the other hand, we also knew of a parallel stream of research, especially in the realm of misinformation research, had suggested that trying to change people's views can have these kind of counterintuitive or backfire type of responses. And so we wanted to kind of put those two theories against each other. And we recruited about 1,200 Republicans and Democrats in the US who use Twitter relatively frequently. And we offered them up to $28 to follow an automated account that they were told would retweet 24 messages a day. Now, they weren't told what those messages would be, but gradually over the month-long study period, we began to turn up the volume of political messaging from the other side. And this included politicians, journalists, advocacy groups, other kinds of pundits that we had identified through some kind of systematic sampling of the Twitter sphere to see what happens when you take people outside their echo chamber. And so for 1 month, people were getting about 24 messages a day that we think they probably wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And of course, you know, we hoped this would make them more moderate. And unfortunately, what we discovered in that study was that exposing people to the other side didn't seem to make them more moderate. In fact, especially for Republicans, it seemed to make people much more extreme. And so we spent a lot of time after that study trying to figure out exactly why that happened.
Right. And just maybe to quell some of the skeptics out there who haven't read the study, you know, how do you know that people saw these actual accounts? And I think it's important to say that you also tweeted, especially towards the beginning, pictures of cute animals that then people were asked about which animals they were, so that you could be sure that they were exposed to the treatment, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Truly adorable creatures. Yeah. Unforgettable.
But as the the political messages from the other side were ramped up, you find that Republicans and Democrats actually got more entrenched in their previous opinions, not more tolerant to the other side. And I think that that goes against what research from deliberation theory would say, which is that, you know, when people are exposed to other opinions, they tend to be more tolerant of those or they moderate their own beliefs. And so I think it's a really kind of puzzling set of results. And we'll get more into your follow-up studies in a second. But I wanted to ask about your general thoughts about polarization as a concept, because I think what you find in this study is evidence for the ideological polarization, which is when people become more extreme and their ideologies move towards different poles. But there's also this idea of effective polarization, which is more about animosity and hatred. There's also, I've heard of values polarization and attitude polarization. And so I'm wondering how you view the concept of polarization. Are these different construals useful for science, or are they leading to a conceptual stretching of the idea?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, I was fortunate to be part of a team of researchers who wrote an article in Science on what we call political sectarianism. It was really about political polarization. And we tried to kind of step back and look across different disciplines, political science, social psychology, sociology, and several other disciplines to try to see, what are the big trends and what are the root causes and what are some possible solutions. And, you know, in doing that large scale interdisciplinary review, we discovered, like you, that, yeah, there's so many different definitions of polarization. And you're right that in this study, the primary focus was on what's often called ideological polarization, what you think about issues, immigration, gun control, inequality, whatever. But there's this other, perhaps more sinister form of polarization that you called affective polarization. And here the idea is essentially that, you know, independent of what you think of the issues, you may develop negative attitudes towards opposing partisans just based on their personhood. And so around 2012, for the first time in American history, basically the frequency with which people hate the other side outpaced the frequency with which they like or love their own side. And that's pretty concerning, I think, when you're thinking about something like deliberation theory that you mentioned earlier, right? The idea here is that when people are put in the same room around a table and asked to figure out a problem, you know, they tend to do well. You know, this kind of like local democracy thing, at least in some of these early studies by the Stanford political scientist James Fishkin and others, you know, and of course there's a deeper intellectual tradition there too, going at least as far back as Habermas. But I think the really important question is, how do you get people to sit down at that table if they've become so hateful towards each other that they really, you know, tend to avoid each other in social spaces, right? I mean, one of the really startling things, some of the research that's come out since I published this book, looking at residential segregation, you know, now a majority of Republicans and Democrats in the US are living in areas where they will seldom or never encounter someone with opposing political views, according to Ryan Enos, a political scientist at Harvard. So yeah, I mean, I think that there certainly are many dimensions to polarization. I might even add to your typology, kind of cultural polarization, you know, looking at we have evidence that Republicans and Democrats are watching different movies and listening to different music and even dating each other less frequently, which has serious implications for demography and then kind of the future of what's often called partisan, you know, sorting or the way that our party identities come to take primacy over all else. So yeah, I discuss some of this in the book, and in some of the later experiments do really try to probe this affective dimension of polarization too.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think polarization more than anything is kind of an outcome state, right? There's a threshold at which something becomes polarized or not. And then the question is really about getting at the mechanisms underpinning that are driving that polarization. I think that's exactly what you do in your second study that you discuss in the book. And in that case, you replicated the experiment with the bots. So programming bots to show partisans counter-attitudinal viewpoints or views from the other side. But in this experiment, you conducted long-form interviews with those users both before and after they got the treatment from the bots. So could you first describe why you decided to take this qualitative approach to probe the findings from the first study? And then kind of what was the process like? What types of conversations did you have with these users?
Yeah. Well, the simple reason was that we didn't know why this, you know, kind of backlash or backfire effect happened. You know, on the one hand, we thought, you know, pretty nice study, pretty carefully designed, rigorously designed. We'd looked at a lot of different dimensions. We also had, you know, relatively massive amount of information about these people, you know, two different surveys, everything they ever tweeted, their, you know, their follower list, you know, what they had for breakfast each morning. Okay, maybe not that, but we had a ton of data on people. So you'd think, especially, you know, emboldened with the tools of data science and machine learning, that we should be able to kind of find some kind of smoking gun in these data that would let us, yeah, figure out what was driving this somewhat counterintuitive finding. And you know, we were just left scratching our heads, even though I think it was 8 or 9 of us on that original paper, you know, again, working for more than a year, couldn't really figure it out. And though a lot of my career has been focused on quantitative and computational techniques, I'm actually the grandchild of Pierre Bourdieu, the great skeptic of survey research. You know, and Bourdieu, of course, famously said, you know, that the public opinion research is just a representation of the public, and it's not actually what the public thinks, and you're measuring how people respond to survey researchers and so on and so forth. But, you know, more broadly, I realized, you know, we just don't have a lot of great research from the point of view of social media users. That's not categorically true. You know, we've got great, you know, inductive work, ethnographic work, qualitative work, but rarely do we get to look at both the 30,000 feet view from quantitative data as well as the qualitative data. And so I wanted to try to do that. And we set out, like you said, to do these interviews and got to meet the people behind the survey responses. And it was enormously illuminating. You know, we got to ask some questions like, you know, tell me about the last time you logged on to your favorite social media site. Tell me about your earliest political memory, you know, and then gradually work up to some of the issues that we had measured in the survey, get into issues like climate change and race and all the kind of divisive issues, but really try to get a sense of how social media was fitting into people's lives. And perhaps most importantly, and I think the major discovery enabled by this kind of comparison was just how different people are online and off. And really, I remember coding one interview late one night thinking, you know, like this is the big finding here. And that was the moment I came up with this idea of the social media prism. I didn't get to the breaking part till later, but much later actually. But yeah, this really yawning gap between social media and reality, which I think we all know exists. You know, you hear people say Twitter is not real life, you know, Facebook is not real life, but we all quickly act as if it is, and we forget because we're so habituated to these systems. So yeah, really, it was an amazing opportunity. I'm very grateful to all the people who took time out of their lives to talk to us and to let us get to know them.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the fun parts of the book and what makes it so accessible is that it's a lot of reporting about these interviews and kind of who the people were online versus offline. I remember one case was, you know, someone who in the interviews was super polite, but then I think you write in the book, so you were just surprised at how, you know, vitriolic this person's tweets were. Mm-hmm. So it really can be, you know, if you're just looking at the social media data, you might have a projection about who these kind of trolls are on the internet, but it doesn't seem to actually match up that way in real life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a pretty stunning case. This particular individual who I called Ray in the book, although there's many others that we met who are similar to this guy. And, you know, you meet him and yeah, he's very polite and goes out of his way to say he's, you know, he doesn't like to talk about politics and he's not racist and this, that, and the other. And then we go to look at the Twitter feed that he produces each night, and it's filled with the most vitriolic, you know, partisan, you know, really unspeakable stuff. It made me question my resolve to do research in this area. It was put that way. I mean, that bad. And yeah, then this question arises: how do you, for what reason does he transform each night, seemingly from, you know, Dr. Jekyll into Mr. Hyde? And you know, that's really where we got into the deeper kind of social psychological motivations that we think propel polarization, which are namely status. And, you know, I think we don't think a lot about status when we think about polarization. I think we're starting to see more evidence of this, but you know, for a sociologist like me, status is just so obviously central to what motivates people. And if we go all the way back to that idea of how we experiment on our identities that I mentioned earlier, you know, status is really our goal with this, you know, continual process of identity experimentation. How do I become the person that is the most valued by others? And so for people like this individual Ray, you know, what we discovered is he really has no source of status in his offline life. He leads a really, I really actually felt bad for the guy after hearing from him. And online, in contrast, you know, he's created this completely different reality where, you know, even if he's getting likes and follows from other relatively extreme social outcasts, there's a kind of belonging there that is, I think, what so many people are striving for, particularly in this era where social inequality is skyrocketing and really, you know, we're losing those opportunities to gain kind of meaningful connections offline. And so, you know, the problem is that people like Ray tend to become increasingly extreme because we think they get a lot more engagement and likes and follows the more extreme they become, and creating this kind of almost like, you know, what Max Weber called church sect theory. You know, the sect always has to go further than the church, almost by definition, you know, to prove its bona fides. And I think that's how a lot of internet radicalization and extremism happens.
Mm. Yeah. And you just touched on it, but I think one of the key findings for these interviews that you discuss throughout the book is this key behavioral difference in how extremists and moderates discuss politics on social media. So could you share some of your insights from those interviews in terms of how differences between extremists and moderates help construct this social media prism?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, extremists and moderates is a little bit of a shorthand. I mean, this is a messy landscape we're talking about here. I mean, extremists, you know, when I use that term, I tend to think more of people like Ray, who are engaged in like willful antagonism and incivility online. They're actually the minority of social media users when we step back and look at research from Pew Survey Research Foundation and other places. You know, it seems like the majority of social media users are actually pretty moderate in their views, just like a majority of Americans are actually pretty moderate in their views. And you know, but you just don't see these people, right? Like nobody who spends 5 minutes interacting on a political issue on Twitter or Facebook is going to say, wow, there's just, you know, so many moderates here. It's like, to the contrary, it seems like everybody's extreme. So, you know, the interesting question, we think status motivates extremists, but we also think status motivates moderates, and specifically different kinds of status. A lot of moderate people derive their sense of self-worth from their family or their career or their, you know, their friends, these kind of offline, more kind of tangible social connections. And for them, engaging in debate, especially political debate on social media, kind of threatens this hard fought and deeply valued status. You know, I think many of the people we interviewed, probably even most of the people, had a story about a friendship that was broken up or a family member who they no longer like look forward to interacting with based on something that they said on social media. And so it creates this kind of effect. This is kind of the other end of the social media prism, where the extremists, you know, really seem like moderates, and the real moderates are kind of invisible. And so we have a lot of stories in the book of people who experienced kind of horrific harassment. And, you know, really the type of people we need to pull our conversation back to some kind of middle, but they're just unwilling to engage in any kind of debate for the reasons I just described.
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting parts of the book is when you discuss how for a lot of these moderates, and you know, we see this both on the left and right wing of American politics, there's these kind of extremist factions, right? You have the progressive wing on the left, and then you have the kind of like pro-Trumpers on the right. And from what you report in the book, a lot of people who, you know, describe themselves as politically moderate, if they express a moderate opinion, oftentimes the attacks come from people within their own party. So it's yeah. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of our biggest problems, in my view. You know, I mean, you know, originally, way back, you know, I'm old enough to remember, like, when the internet first became a thing, you know, like, it was supposed to be a massive open marketplace of ideas where arguments compete with each other based on their merit, and everybody has access to information, And, you know, like clearly that's not at all what's happened. You know, we've seen pretty much just the opposite. And so, you know, thinking about ways to create spaces where rational debate can happen is really important. But I think we also need to recognize that we shouldn't romanticize the past too much either. You know, I think a lot of, you mentioned deliberation theory earlier, I think a lot of that rests on some shaky ground too. You know, we're kind of always thinking about this mythical past where we were in a town square and almost as if like, you know, watching Socrates, you know, like lead an argument. And really, you know, if you begin to read the historical research, and I'm no historian, but I aspire to be an amateur historian, you know, through reading the work of others, you know, really what I see is just we've actually never really had that kind of ideal form of deliberation. And yes, it can be created with a lot of work and cultivation, intervention by researchers or others, but it doesn't seem to happen very often naturally in the wild. And so, you know, I think we need to be careful not to romanticize this too much, but we are in this position, I think, where, you know, on the left, you have a lot of Democrats who may feel uneasy about voicing concerns about defunding the police, for example. I think that's a, you know, prominent example right now. One of my graduate students has done some interesting research that shows people seem really reluctant to voice that view in front of other Democrats, precisely because of the dynamic you just shared about people getting punished from their own side. And on the right, of course, you know, any type of lack of fealty to Trump, you know, or questioning the election outcome, or, you know, not being willing to question the election outcome really seems to have left people alone on an island on the right too. And we see people are really unwilling to express those kinds of concerns too. And, you know, fundamentally, there's the immediate effect of that, right? Those people feel disempowered, they give up, they feel apathetic and helpless. But the deeper effect, and the one I'm more concerned about, is, you know, when other people come log on to social media, they think, well, everybody on the left must think we should defund the police, and everybody on the right must think that, you know, the election was stolen, when really this isn't the case. And that's, again, why I think we need to try to figure out ways to kind of break this social media prism here.
Definitely. And before we move into that part in your third study, I want to touch on what you just said, which I think is a key outcome of the book, which is this idea of false polarization, yet another polarization nuance that has been around for a while, but I hadn't heard of it until reading the book. And I think this is kind of the dynamic that you're finding. So could you describe what false polarization is?
Yeah, and you're right. This idea has been around for a long time. There's a lot of great research going all the way back to the 1980s. In fact, even back in the 90s, you know, a lot of people were concerned about culture wars, you know, and back then it was, you know, abortion and welfare. These are kind of the issues that seemed, if you read media coverage of the issues, you know, kind of intractable, and that, you know, America was just on a collision course. And the great sociologist Paul DiMaggio and some colleagues did some interesting research at the time that suggested actually, you know, things don't seem any more polarized on issues like abortion than they were 20 years ago. And so there's already evidence a long time ago that perceptions of polarization were out of step with actual political divisions. And then around the same time, some researchers at Harvard began kind of a clever study where they asked a bunch of undergraduates, you know, what do you think the other side thinks about different issues? And what do you think your own side thinks? And what they discovered, which is now been demonstrated across a lot of different settings, is that people tend to exaggerate the ideological extremity of the other side and minimize the ideological extremity of their own side, which makes everyone feel more polarized. And there's evidence of this in media and, you know, kind of legacy media or newspapers and television transcripts, some good research that shows that exposing people to even journal articles or newspaper articles about the breadth of polarization makes them feel more polarized. There's a great book by Jamie Settle called Frenemies, which demonstrates the breadth of false polarization on Facebook too. And so really, I was just trying to lay another brick by linking this to perceptions of status and broader theories of politics and technology. But yeah, we see time and again that people exaggerate the extremity of the other side. The good news is that correcting these types of misperceptions, false polarization, either about issues or about what the other side thinks of your side, getting again into that affective dimension, seems to really improve polarization. It makes people think the other side is more reasonable, less volatile, and more eager to compromise. So, you know, so much of getting past polarization on social media, I think, requires developing solutions to false polarization and thinking about how we can break out of this prism that leaves us all feeling more polarized than we really are.
Yeah, it's also interesting for me, who's an American but doesn't live there. You know, if you just listen to the media reporting, you look on social media, it sounds like, you know, everyone's at each other's throats. Then you actually go to the US and people are generally pretty cool. You know, you don't really see that in day-to-day life. Everyone's like talking on the bus, whatever. It's always just fun, funny kind of disconnect there. So I think that argument really stuck for me as well. But let's go into your third study, where in the first two, you're observing this phenomenon, you're looking into the mechanisms that might explain it. And so what you decided to do was to build an alternative social media platform that would remove some of these status-seeking mechanisms that you argue might contribute to this ideological extremism. And that leads us to this experiment around a platform called DiscussIt. So could you describe DiscussIt for us? What was kind of the key concept behind it? What features did you include and not include? And then how did you actually go about building the platform?
Yeah. Well, you know, what we would have loved to do is run a series of follow-up field experiments to try to kind of help people overcome this status-seeking and identity dynamic that we think is kind of filtering and preventing people from really connecting across party lines. And we would have liked to have said, you know, hey, Facebook, let us, you know, for example, make people anonymous and see whether that makes things better or worse. And some of the research here was kind of interesting because on the one hand, we knew about, you know, people like this guy, Ray, who are so clearly hiding behind the guise of anonymity and saying things they would never say in real life. And that's an obvious negative. But on the other hand, anonymity gives us the freedom to explore unpopular ideas outside of social pressure from either the other side or, as you were saying earlier, our own side. You know, so if you have complicated views on race and policing, for example, you might not want to talk about them if your identity is linked to it, because, you know, you might get harassed or otherwise, you know, you might have some negative outcome. But in an anonymous format, well, maybe you would actually share your views. And so we wanted to be able to do a field experiment where we could kind of turn on and off anonymity. And to do this, we actually, as you said, we had to create our own social media platform, which required quite a bit of work, you know, everything from creating a legally licensed corporation to staffing a user support, you know, team during the study itself. I can't recommend this type of study for those who are not ready to get their hands dirty, let's say. But the payoff is pretty cool because you get to control, you know, any feature of the platform and really try to see what happens when you experiment on the guts of social media. You know, we can only do so much at the user level. What if this incentive structure that I was discussing earlier, where, you know, we've incentivized this radicalized behavior, what if fixing that requires changing the incentives? And so, you know, this is a research paradigm that we, you know, we're continuing to work on now in the polarization lab, and hopefully we'll do a number of future studies. But basically what we discovered, is somewhat counterintuitively that putting Democrats and Republicans, once again, a large group of people who recruited, we asked them if they would help us, quote, test a new social media platform. And then we had them, you know, unbeknownst to them, they were discussing an issue such as immigration or gun control with a member of the other party. And what we found is that people who participated in these anonymous discussions became much, much less polarized, and especially Republicans. In fact, Republicans depolarized at a rate of about 6 times that of Democrats. So pretty substantial effects, and again, somewhat surprising.
Definitely, because, I mean, there's a lot of research looking at anonymity as an affordance, for example. Mm-hmm. And it tends to argue that in platforms where anonymity is allowed and users can be anonymous, that there tends to be higher levels of incivility and trolling, presumably because people can't be tied to their identity. So what do you think explains that discrepancy between your kind of controlled experiment and what researchers tend to find kind of in the wild?
Well, I think one issue is, you know, in the wild, there's a huge selection effect, right? I mean, if we just go onto an anonymous platform and start to look for evidence of incivility, you know, we we're going to kind of gravitate towards these horrific cases like 4chan or, you know, Yik Yak and all these other kind of somewhat older cases where, you know, just terrific things happen in these anonymous formats. But we're not actually taking regular people and saying, okay, you go to this anonymous, you know, section and you go to this other one. We're just saying, given that there are a lot of anonymous people on the internet, and let's go look for evidence of how they behave. But we're not asking who are the people and what motivates them to do this. And so if you can take away some of that extremist element, I think, I mean, this, you know, like all good researchers, we're still trying to make sense of these findings. But my own take is that, you know, people actually appreciate the opportunity to connect outside of the kind of typical partisan warfare that we're all used to and I think have become a nerd. The funny thing about this study, you know, in addition to generating a lot of quantitative outcomes, we had a lot of transcripts of chats, you know, what people actually said on the platform. And I actually read all 800 conversations that we had on this platform. And, you know, they're really remarkable. I mean, yes, there are a few that went awry, one in particular that went so badly and became so hateful that we had to shut down the conversation. But the vast majority were really actually very positive. You know, another example is a couple that actually apparently on our platform, you know, started a grassroots campaign around gun control and suicide prevention. And we were able to see them kind of take this off to Facebook, and others who just, you know, more, now that's an extreme example on the other end, but, you know, the modal outcome, because we measured all sorts of different, you know, dimensions of this, was people saying things like, wow, I didn't think this was going to go this way. Or, you know, it was really interesting to hear your views. So these were the type of things that, again, we wouldn't have expected.
Definitely. And more in line with this kind of classic deliberative approach, right? That's the
right.
What we would hope for, but is, yeah, as you say, often stands on somewhat shaky ground. But towards the end of the book, kind of armed with all this knowledge, you offer three suggestions for how to break the social media prism and ultimately decrease polarization. And this is kind of the million-dollar question that seemingly everyone wants the answer to, right? How can we depolarize this this mess we've gotten ourselves into? And most people, especially regulators, are looking to platforms to fix the problem through an algorithm tweak or some souped-up form of content moderation. But your suggestions focus more on us as individuals. So what can we do to break this social media prism? And what role do you see platforms playing in this equation?
Yeah, I mean, this is the, like you said, this is the big question, and there are no easy answers. I mean, there's, you know, polarization is such a complex problem, right? It predates social media, and I think everybody wants to know, is social media polarizing us or not? Or, you know, and that's just too facile a question, really. I think so. To really answer this question, we have to do a lot of soul searching to really get at the broader social roots of polarization. But on social media, I think the good news is there's some relatively low cost interventions that both social media users can do and also platforms can implement to really make things a lot better. So at the user level, you know, there's a simple set of things like, first, learn to see this social media prism, learn to see and constantly remind yourself that the people who you're interacting with are not, you know, not a random sample of the population. They're a group of largely status seeking extremists who are, you know, out to get a rise out of people and are not the type of people who you should be confusing with people on the other side. Also thinking about how your own behavior contributes to this dynamic. You know, I don't think many extremists are going to pick up my book in the first place, or even if they did, that they'll say, oh, you know, this guy's got a point. Maybe I'll be a little less extreme. I think most people, though, on the moderate side, you know, I hope that some moderate readers will pick it up and say, huh, you know, I need to do some self-reflection about the cost benefit here. You know, it's been easy and convenient to avoid talking about politics, but I'm also part of the problem here if I'm not willing to engage and I'm being intimidated by others. And, you know, we really need, I think, more moderate folks to kind of, you know, come back to the conversation, because I think they were part of the conversation and largely left. And that's a really critical area where I think we could get more moderates engaged, we would really go a long way in breaking the social media prism. And the kind of perhaps unique experiment I tried with this book, and we are trying as our lab, is to actually create technology that can help people implement some of the solutions in the book, which you might call like middleware technology, which is like technology that you can plug into your Twitter account that can help you see whether the political statements you make online are in line with your real views, or learn how to identify and avoid extremists, or follow bots that we think can depolarize people. These are all the types of things that we think technology can do kind of from the bottom up and at the user level, even without interacting with the platforms themselves. But at the platform level, there's a number of things that can be done. I think the first and most powerful is to think about how to change the incentives. You know, many people I think now know, and even apparently Facebook itself now knows, and has probably long known, that when you optimize for engagement, when you give people the reward of likes or follows or move their posts higher in the newsfeed so that more people see it, based upon engagement or how many people are interacting with the post or liking it and commenting and so on, you're going to see more extreme views because people are simply preaching to the choir or kind of picking fights. But what if instead of upvoting or boosting that kind of divisive though engaging content, you boosted content based on its appeal to both sides? So you saw, you know, more posts that are getting liked or engaged with by diverse groups of people. And of course, you know, in the realm of politics, we might think about Republicans and Democrats. But I think in this way, social media could really be optimized for democracy more broadly, you know, like show us the stuff that people across different demographic groups are liking. Don't just show me what my own side is upset about. And in this way, I think you could start to change some of the patterns because you'd create an incentive for people to engage in more bridging behavior. You'd create, you know, a kind of status around reaching out. And, you know, we've tried to do that a little bit again in the lab with our bipartisanship leaderboard, which is a ranking of prominent politicians, journalists, and other kind of activists who we rank according to their appeal to both sides. So people who are more appealing to both Republicans and Democrats are higher up on the leaderboard. And then, of course, we made bots to retweet them, too, to try to actually allow people to take control of their newsfeed if, well, you know, social media platforms are not yet quite willing to do so.
Yeah, as you said, I think moderates play an important role here. And of course, they can be boosted by the platforms. But I think in most cases, listeners to this podcast are pretty rational and pretty moderate. So hopefully they will pick up the book and do a bit of introspection on the social media prism. So Professor Bale, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing your research with us.
Sure. It's my pleasure. Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I've just been speaking with Chris Bale, professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University. Check the episode description for a link to his latest book, Breaking the Social Media Prism. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Stay tuned. Got a lot of great academic content coming your way. Everything from how political leaders signal mask wearing on social media to online jihadist radicalization and its backfire effects. So until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Meltlow. See you next time.